This meeting is now being recorded.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the meeting of the jurisdiction subgroup on August 1st, 2017 at 1300 UTC. First, we'll review the agenda. After a minute of administration, we'll go to our main event for the day, which is the presentation by Samantha Eisner from ICANN Legal on OFAC, including a time for questions and answers, including the questions that have been placed on the ICANN list. I don't believe that Sam has seen the questions that came in overnight. Perhaps she did, overnight for me at least, in New York. After that, if we have time, well, I would like to take advantage of, I think we would all like to take advantage of Sam's presence to discuss the further ICANN Legal's positions and on the lack of choice of law provisions in registrar and registry agreements. And then we'll have AOB, and then we will adjourn after that until next week. I see a suggestion that we approve the agenda. That has not been a procedure in this subgroup in the past, so we're not going to adopt that procedure. Now, Cavus, I see your hand is up. Please keep it
yes,
brief.
Yes,
thank you.
Yes, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. Yes, not exactly. I don't understand why you want to exclude this time you go to the not procedural agenda is to be approved. And the approval of agenda that people should be given the opportunity to express their views about the agenda. So I don't think that you should decide on that unilaterally, saying that without going to the the procedure. So I think we need to discuss. There is a difficulty with this agenda. There is a difficulty with the timing of the meeting. We have to discuss that. I don't think that we should do that. There's something very abnormally occurred and some deficiencies with the arrangement of the meetings and so on. So please kindly allow us in a free, democratic, and inclusive way to express our views. And this is something that's quite necessary. So I have some comments on the deficiencies, problems of organizing the meeting and agenda in particular with respect to the OFAC issues. So I am not in favor of going to presentation of some before we have to do something. If we agree on that, then we go to the presentation. However, you totally disagreed with what I have suggested. You totally misarranged the situation. You have a statement asking whether people are in opposition to my proposal. You should have put it in a positive way, whether the people they have difficulty, whether the people agree with my proposal. Put it in a positive way. You put it in negative. And within 2 hours, you just established to a draft agenda. That is not possible. How do you expect that within 2 hours, with so much difference in time around the world, the people react to your suggestion? Your suggestion was 10:05, and your agenda was 12:25. 2 hours and 24 minutes.
So it's been 2 minutes. Can we move on, please?
No. I cannot. You should not. Yes, please kindly allow me to speak. Please kindly. I beg you. I appeal to you. Don't override, please. The procedure was not okay. This is number one. Number two, now we have 15 questions. I don't think that before going to the question and prioritize the question, we should ask them to give us explanation. What explanation? We don't need any description of the OFAC. We have more than thousands of pages. First, you have to have questions and some reply to the question only, but not introduction, not briefing, not background, and nothing. So please kindly don't waste our time. Let us go to the questions to see which are the questions which Merit has
Caboose, that's been 3 minutes.
I'm not asking some to provide
to,
that information. Please, kindly, allow us to speak, kindly. This is a democratic way. Don't override the people.
Caboose,
you are,
you are alone.
I'm
going to ask you to stop now.
Yeah, but we don't want to explain anything at all. First, we have to go through the questions. What are the 15 questions? Which one should prioritize? And then she will be given this question. She prepare something, present that at some other time with prior submission of the written document on what she presents. This time, I just reduce it to that. If you want to present something, she should have discussion.
I'll ask you to stop at 4 minutes,
Caboose. So I don't understand, and I don't agree with your way of procedure. Please kindly bear with us. Thank you very much, sir.
Caboose, thank you for your 4 minutes. Is there any support for anything that Caboose has said? I see no support on
the objection.
Is there any opposition?
You should ask whether there is any objection, not any support. Is there any objection? Who objects to that? How many from this?
Caboose, if you'd like to volunteer to be a rapporteur of a meeting and
let's just be friends with each other. Kindly.
Okay, there is no opposition.
I beg you.
I
appeal to you.
And I will ask Sam to begin her presentation.
No, no presentation. On what? We don't want any presentation. What issue? We don't want to present something. We don't want that. Please let us see. So what is the issue that I propose to go through the question?
You're out of order.
Go through the question first and to see which one to be raised, and then some reply to that. We want that all the replies.
Rapporteur asked that the staff kindly close the microphone of all those who are not
but that you should listen to the people.
You
have no right to cut the
Speaking
microphone.
Forward.
Yeah, you cannot cut the microphone, please. This is not a dictatorship. This is a friendly meeting. What is the
Caboose,
problem that you go through the question?
Please put them on the list. You're wasting everybody's time right now. Sam woke up at 5 in the morning to be on this call, so you can go out
but
and have your
presentation?
Happy Sam woke up in the dark.
Presentation on
Matthew,
what?
Stop
what
now.
Do you want to present?
Caboose, it's 9 minutes after the hour. You're embarrassing yourself. Please stop.
But what she's going to present? Can you explain, please, sir? Can you explain what she's going to present? Just this question. Very small. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. This is
Thank
Sam
you.
Eisner from ICANN Legal. Greg, did you want me to go ahead?
Yes, Sam. Please go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. Staff is getting up the a short presentation that I put together. I've been watching some of the questions on the list that have come up around OFAC, and so this is a fairly general presentation, but I think it'll answer some of the questions and indeed some of the misunderstandings around OFAC and the application of OFAC to ICANN and how ICANN can or cannot require OFAC to be applied to its contracted parties. And then there will be some time for questions at the end. So here's a general overview of the things I'm going to touch on today. So let's start off just at a really high level. OFAC is the Office of Foreign Assets Control. It's part of the U.S. Department of Treasury. It was created in 1950. There were precursors to it dating all the way back to the 1800s. And its mission is to administer and enforce economic sanctions programs primarily against countries and groups of individuals such as terrorists and narcotics traffickers. This, of course, is information you can find from the OFAC website. I know, Greg, you sent around a lot of links and some different information on the OFAC program. Just in general, OFAC has what they term country-specific programs as well as a specially designated nationals list of individuals and companies with which U.S. persons are generally prohibited from dealing. And so what that means is if you go onto the OFAC website, and we can put the links into the chat room if this would be helpful for people. You can go and find the different programs that are applicable to countries. Sometimes they're they're of broader range than others, but typically the sanctions go to particular types of conduct. And then the specially designated nationals list, those can be people or entities, so it includes businesses from a broader range of countries than those that are included on the country programs. But there are some of the country programs that are so broad that it would cover any person or entity that's within that country. So that there would be prohibitions or certain types of restrictions on how U.S. persons could deal with those entities. And it's important to know when you're looking at OFAC, so the U.S. is not the only country that has systematic embargoes like what the OFAC list represents. There's other embargo lists such as in Japan and the U.K. There's in the EU, Switzerland recently in the past decade or so put into place a pretty robust International Sanctions Act. So this isn't something that's unique to the United States. And so if you're looking at other jurisdictions, you also have to think about what are their sanctions regimes, what kinds of embargoes do they place on people doing business within their country, doing business with people who would be on lists such as the SDN list or subject to other trade sanctions. So in general, OFAC prohibits providing goods and services to countries under sanction and those persons and entities under the SDN list. And so it implies generally, OFAC applies generally to those who fall under the jurisdiction of the U.S., so businesses here or U.S. citizens. And if companies or people don't comply, the repercussions are actually very high. So there, not only can there be fines that can go into the millions, but this is actually a matter of criminal liability in some cases. And so, you know, if a company like ICANN were to not follow the OFAC requirements that it's bound to follow by law, you could find an officer of ICANN going to jail for that. So we take our compliance obligations with the OFAC requirements very seriously. And Barzi, I see your note that OFAC does not only apply to the SDN list, it applies to ordinary people as well. And Farzi, I agree. And this is when you look at that, the country type sanctions as opposed to the SDN list. As I said earlier, the country sanctions, if they're extremely broad, will apply to any individual or person who is from that area. And so it does go broader than just the list. So this slide that was supposed to be here says, how did it become applicable to ICANN? So why is ICANN subject to OFAC? And so really, ICANN is subject to OFAC by virtue of doing business in the U.S. and having a place of operations here. ICANN has been obligated to comply with OFAC rules since its formation. I've seen some suggestion on the list and some questions as to what the relationship has been between ICANN and the NTIA and the requirement to follow OFAC requirements. And there really is no connection. The IANA functions contract had nothing to do with ICANN being obligated to follow OFAC. There's no clause in there that specifically says ICANN must follow OFAC, et cetera. It's just by virtue of ICANN being a U.S. business and having a place of operations in the U.S. that it must follow it. And there's been no change in ICANN's obligation to follow OFAC obligations since the transition. Going back, and Jeff, I see your question in the chat. I think that was a follow-up from my response to Farzi. You have a question that says, is it for people from that area or living in that area? And it is indeed from that area. It applies to people who, if it's a country that has a really broad sanctions regime against it, such as Sudan, for example, it applies to Sudanese nationals, even if they're not living in Sudan anymore, but they're carrying a Sudanese passport, right? It could have a very broad reach. So what would happen if ICANN wasn't headquartered in the U.S.? Would there be a change in ICANN's obligation to follow the OFAC rules? And that would be a really fact-intensive issue. But from the way that ICANN's business is set up now, just moving a headquarter out of the U.S. would really make no difference. ICANN has such a large amount of business contacts and conducts so much business within the U.S. that it would probably still keep ICANN under U.S. jurisdiction for the purposes of OFAC. So this isn't something that you can, if you have concerns about how OFAC impacts ICANN's operations, it's not something that you can solve by just picking ICANN up and moving it someplace else. These are still things that would impact ICANN and how it does business for years to come unless you really change an overall structure of what ICANN did. And so I know one of the things that I've seen discussed is what's the interplay between ICANN, its contracted parties, the registries and registrars, and OFAC compliance? So first, do ICANN's registry and registrar agreements specifically require OFAC compliance? So does the just by virtue of a registrar or registry coming into existence, no matter where they do business, do they have to comply with OFAC? And so, really, no. ICANN's agreements require that contracted parties follow their applicable laws. And so it's up to each entity to decide what laws apply to them. Many of them will have business operations in the U.S. such that they have their own independent obligation to follow OFAC requirements. But that's not something that ICANN tells them to do. That is their own legal compliance issue. And so how do ICANN's contracted parties become subject to OFAC? Again, it goes back to their own personal compliance regime. So it's up to each registry and registrar to determine if they must follow OFAC. But again, ICANN does not do anything to make this happen. ICANN doesn't tell registries and registrars where to set up their businesses, where to put their offices, which customers to engage with, et cetera. And so if you've heard a report, for example, about a registrar that's unable to register a domain name due to OFAC issues, that's not something that ICANN places on them. That's their own individual compliance requirement to follow the laws that the registrar is bound to follow. ICANN doesn't mandate the laws that a registrar needs to follow. So this next page says, can ICANN become exempt from OFAC? And so companies don't become uniformly exempt from following sanctions regimes, at least in the U.S. So there's nothing that ICANN could do to just say, U.S. government, absolve us from having to follow any part of the OFAC regime. But there are times, there are types of conduct that the government, either through regulations or through legislation, have actually provided general licenses for. So they might carve out certain things. So it could be that, in general, there's a certain type of financial transaction that's prohibited, but it could be written into legislation that if it's about a very particular type, that's actually exempted from OFAC through a general license. So that's one thing that ICANN or any other company could take advantage of and could avail itself of if those general licenses existed. But then also there's an opportunity to apply for a specific license. And what a specific license is that an entity can apply for authorization to engage in a particular kind of conduct or transaction. So I saw earlier, Farzi, in the chat that you referenced that you've heard that ICANN has to get an OFAC license for you when providing travel support. And so not to talk about any individual or situation, but in general, we, like for Fellows, for example, we and for our whole travel support list, indeed, we look and we identify if we do need to apply for a license for any of the identified travelers to travel to a meeting, for ICANN to provide the support, the financial support to bring someone to a meeting. Now, we don't have to get a license for anyone who might choose to come to an ICANN meeting on their own. We don't look at our registration agreement list that way. But if it's someone who's seeking travel support through ICANN to receive the ICANN funding and support, we do look and we do obtain, we request and we obtain licenses for that specific conduct. So it is something that we can, we've done for a very long time and will continue doing to facilitate participation in ICANN meetings. Now, with the ability to apply for a specific license, there is not the obligation for OFAC to grant the specific license. There's also not an obligation from OFAC as to an SLA as to how quickly they will process a request for a license. And so, really, when you step back and you look at how ICANN handles itself, in general, ICANN will not provide goods or services to any country for which sanctions apply or for any person or entity on the SDN list unless a general license exists that would exempt the conduct or unless ICANN is granted a specific license. And so that in a nutshell is how OFAC applies to ICANN's operations. This is really our compliance statement about how we do it. And, you know, experience has shown we do apply for licenses. We've had we've been successful in hosting meetings across the world and in participating in trainings across the world and bringing people to ICANN meetings from across the world and in doing our work. And so this isn't anything new for us. It's a regular part of compliance, just like any other U.S.-based business or business that has operations in the U.S. would do. So with that, let me go to – I see Milton's question in the chat, and then we'll turn over the question into – and I see, Jeff, your question in the chat, too. I'll address those two first, and then I'll open the floor for questions. So, Milton, you have the question. U.S. Congress would have to create a general license or the Treasury. And so that – in terms of general licenses, they can be created through multiple ways. So it could be something that's written into legislation, which would be – through the Congress. But if it's more of a regulation, those tend to be promulgated by agencies. So that could be a Treasury-specific regulation that's drafted, or there could be, you know, interagency work that helps put that together. But, I mean, I don't know fully how that would work, but I know that we could see it either through legislation or regulation, so there are two avenues for that. And then, Jeff, I see your question. Are licenses by the individual, or can you get a group license? So that really depends on the case. It depends on the circumstance. So if we have a group of people who are traveling to an ICANN meeting, for example, who are on our funded traveler list, we actually have to get a license for each specific person because the license if they're covered in some way that we would need to seek the license, we actually have to apply individually. And if anyone on the call has been through the process, like we often need to provide information on travel dates or giving more information about a specific meeting. So it's not even just like a general license for the purpose of going to ICANN meetings, but it actually is tethered to specific ICANN meetings. And that we'd reapply if there are more meetings. So we could apply for multiple meetings at once, for example, but we need to get it actually specific to the person and specific to the meeting for that type of travel. Now, there could be some licenses for conduct that we would seek. And so if it's a particular type of conduct that, you know, if it's a particular business transaction we were interested in or something, then you'd have to look at those become more country specific. And so there's not a way to go to OFAC and say, okay, there's a particular type of conduct that you have prohibited ICANN or U.S. companies from doing across, you know, 10 different countries. And so I want you to give me one license for those 10, for that conduct for 10 different countries. You would actually have to apply for 10 different licenses that go to each of the country-specific programs. It's a little bit clunky, but it is something that you can learn to navigate and work with them. So we have Phil Corwin, has U.S. Treasury ever denied a specific license requested by ICANN? If so, on what grounds? I do not do our direct OFAC license work. I'm not aware of any situations where we've had a specific license request denied from the things that I've seen and the things I've heard, but I'm not aware of any time that we've had a specific license request denied. But I do know that sometimes they take longer than you would expect them to take. So I think I've gone through the questions in the chat. Greg, do you want me to just handle the queue on the Adobe list?
Thank you, Sam. I can handle the queue. And anybody else would like to ask questions, please get in the queue. Jeff Newman, please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. I appreciate you getting up real early for this, and this has been really helpful for me. Question for you on IANA changes. So for the countries that are covered under OFAC or excluded or however you want to classify them, is there a general legislation or is there a general license that you can make changes to IANA from if requests come in from the authorized entities from that country? In other words, if they want to change their contact information or want to change name servers or whatever, is there a general license, legislation, anything that gives ICANN the right to make those changes without having to seek a specific case-by-case license?
Thanks, Jeff. There is not a general license that exempts that type of work. So historically, and we've continued to, even with the NTIA out, so historically we've worked with NTIA, because NTIA was the one that authorized the root zone changes, ICANN would support NTIA in making those applications to get the licenses, and the licenses for root zone changes tend not to be just for each specific root zone change, but actually exist for a period of time. So I don't know the specifics of whether it's a year or 2 years or something like that, but they actually cover a period of time. So it's not that every time a root zone change would come in just to change a name server or to change a technical contact or something, that we'd have to go seek an OFAC license to make a specific change. We are able to get kind of a less specific description of what the conduct is in our root zone work to do that. And so now with NTIA out, that is the one thing that's changed is that we are now the applicant directly to Treasury as opposed to NTIA being the applicant, but we basically do the same work and description and preparing all the paperwork, et cetera. And so we've applied for and always received as necessary the licenses to do that root zone work. And again, they're not just for specific one-off changes. They cover a period of time. And in terms of the SLAs, they're not necessarily exempted from SLAs, but they are this is the place where it's really important for there to be communication between the IANA function operator and the entity to understand if there was a delay based on seeking an OFAC license.
Thank you, Sam.
Sure.
I see that there's a follow-up question from Milton before we go to Farzana. Follow-up question to this. which is I don't understand how a root zone change would require an OFAC license.
So, Milton, I don't know the specifics of why there's been a determination that an OFAC, that this was applicable under OFAC. However, we know that the Treasury has found it important to issue a license in these instances, and so it is conduct that is deemed to be appropriate. And sometimes it just has to do with the breadth of sanctions against any country. And so it's a very small group of countries that we would need to seek this type of license for to perform root zone changes, particularly around the CCTLD. But it does happen. The less broad the sanctions are that are part of the country-specific programs from Treasury, the less likely it is that we would need to do that. So, yeah, basically for the countries that you've mentioned. And the SDN list is as well, right? I mean, if we had a company on the SDN list, that would be something that would require particular attention.
Thanks, Sam. Why don't we go to Farzana now?
Yes. Hi, Farzana Baidi speaking. Thank you very much, Sam. This is very useful. Just a question on the registrar's agreement. You mentioned that the agreements with ICANN do not require them to follow OFAC rules if they are not located in the U.S. Are they briefed on this issue? Does the compliance tell them that they are not obliged to follow OFAC if they are not located in the U.S.? And even one step further, if it would be a viable option to kind of deter them from applying OFAC for no valid reason if they don't have to follow it. Because I have seen two cases that it seems like in their agreements with the registrants, they have just like copy-pasted from other registrars and they follow OFAC rules while they are not located in the U.S. So I was wondering if from ICANN a solution could come out that they tell the registrars in the registrar that they do not have to, the registrars in the registrar agreement that they do not have to follow OFAC rules if they are not located in the U.S.
Thanks, Farzi. So in general, ICANN's, neither ICANN's legal team or ICANN's compliance team ever advises, we never advise our contracted parties that we work with as to what laws apply to them or which laws don't. We don't know the specific facts and details about how each registrar or registry organizes their business. And so it's really not ICANN. It's not up to ICANN to tell them whether or not they are subject to the OFAC requirements or not. They really need to look at how their own business is run, and they need to get they often will need to have counsel give them advice as to whether or not there's a need for them to regularly check against the OFAC list, to follow the OFAC compliance laws, to seek licenses, et cetera. That's really not a place for ICANN to make a determination, because if we were wrong and a registrar relied on ICANN telling them that they didn't have to follow it, I'm not sure how that would all fall out. It's very important from the ICANN point of view that registrars and registries are bound to follow the laws that they are bound to follow. And so that's why we don't name in our agreement what they must do in terms of specific laws. But on the converse of that, we also don't give advice about the things we think they don't have to do. That's really up to each business that enters the space. Greg, I think we can move
Thank you, Sam.
Continue to move.
Caboose, why don't you go ahead, please? With your question.
Hello. First of all, I understood that something that for participation and traveling, our offers may apply, and I can would seek for some general arrangement authorization. This is quite seems quite unusual. The OFAC refers to transaction with a U.S. national. Does not talk about any registrar outside or inside USA. Yes, if the registrar inside the USA, they may be subject to national law. But the whole issue is referred to the transaction with the nationals from the U.S. So if the registrar is outside the U.S. and they are not national, they are not going to ask for any OFAC authorization. Is that right or wrong? That should be answered quite clearly. And in several questions, Sam says that I don't know. So I don't think that that is convincing. She doesn't know, yes, someone should know. Someone should ask. And in others, she says that, yes, it is not up to the ICANN, so it is up to whom? We have difficulty to that. The domain name users ask to register or registrar to take, to acquire, to buy, and so on and so forth, and it is rejected saying that you need the OFAC license. And now some says that yes, it is up to the people to go to the result. It is up to the demander in, for instance, country X to go to the U.S. and ask about authorization. There is no relation at all. So what is that? What is the inclusiveness? So we need to look at the matter. Having said that, I think that all of the question has been raised need carefully a written answer without saying that we don't know. Someone should know. It is nothing that we don't know. And some of the issues is quite not convincing, saying that a registrar located outside has nothing to do with the location. It has to do with the nationals of a particular country or U.S. country. It's not location and so on and so forth. So maybe location is another branch of that. Maybe location, because somebody located in USA, is subject to the application of U.S. law. But U.S. law, that should be addressed differently. So I think some of the questions still need to be carefully examined and need to be answered in a written form. You need to have time to go through that, take into account of the chat and the transcript to see what it is. So there are a lot of things that have not been answered. Thank you.
Thank you, Kavir. Sam, please go ahead.
Sure. Thanks, Caboose. So, you know, if there are additional questions that you think that answers are required for, you know, please let us know. I hear some frustration with my saying, you know, we don't know when OFAC might apply to our contracted parties, for example, and that's actually a fully legitimate answer for ICANN to have. ICANN, as Phyllis said in the chat, ICANN doesn't provide legal advice to contracted parties, and we're not a law enforcement body. The people who know are the company themselves, who know the facts and circumstances of how they operate their business, and any law enforcement body that might actually wish to charge them with a violation of the law. Those are not choices for ICANN to make. And I know one of the things that I know can be a bit surprising, and I think that this also goes to Milton's question earlier about how can a route zone change be subject to OFAC. And Caboose, I've heard your focus on transactions. OFAC regulations are often seen as applying mostly to financial institutions. A lot of them have to do with money. But at base, when you go under them, They're about providing goods or services. And so sometimes the things that we do are looked at as providing a service. And so it might not have the general, when you look at it just on its face, it might not look like the transaction that you would think would need to be covered. But particularly depending on the breadth of sanctions that have been issued against the country, certain conduct might actually cross that line in the U.S. government's eyes, into providing services. And so you can't just take it down to a transaction between companies to make the test of what conduct falls under OFAC and what conduct doesn't. But again, if you have additional questions that you think that and that this group believes haven't been answered through this presentation or outside sources, please let us know. Greg?
Thanks, Sam. I'll go to Milton Mueller.
Hello. Good morning, Sam. I wanted to ask, I understand that ICANN doesn't want to provide legal advice and doesn't want to, particularly if they make the wrong decision, they don't want to be advising registrars on tracted parties. By the same token, is it possible that the registrar, the contracted party, could also make a wrong decision about the applicability of the law to them? And in terms of remedies, in other words, they might, out of a conservatism or fear, they might adopt or implement certain restrictions when it's actually not necessary. So my first question is that possible? My second question is there anything we can ask the U.S. government to do to clarify those kinds of situations so that we reduce the restrictions to only people that really they should be applied to?
So Milton, thank you. I think that the potential for any company to be too conservative in the application of a law, particularly a law such as OFAC that carries high sanctions with it, or high, you know, sanctions to anyone who doesn't comply as well, I think that's a very real possibility. Now, in terms of how that interacts with the ICANN sphere, there's always a possibility to ask the U.S. government to help get clearer on conduct. Like, what types of conduct would we want them to say should be carved out from this activity, right? What types of conduct would you imagine to have in a general license, for example, if one was to be developed? And then the question comes to who would do the asking? What type of funding would there be for that type of lobbying, et cetera? I could imagine just from my limited interactions with the U.S. government that trying to move towards such a general to having some sort of regulation or legislation promulgated through the U.S. government could be a very lengthy thing. It's not that it's not worth doing, but then you have the question of, you know, who's the appropriate party to move for that. It would be a question among the ICANN community, I think, to talk about where the funds for that would happen, where the lines should be drawn, what's in and out. And then, of course, no outcome is ever guaranteed when you're working with a governmental body.
Sam, I see a follow-up question in the chat from Steve Del Bianco, which Barzana concurs. Sam, can you say that contracted parties are not obligated to follow OFAC solely on the basis of their having a contract with ICANN?
Steve, yes. That was one of the things I was talking about earlier in the presentation. Just by virtue of having a contract with ICANN does not do anything to define what laws you must follow, what regimes you must follow, including OFAC. That really is something that each company has to look at to decide whether or not they believe that their contract with ICANN, if that's the only contract they have with the U.S., is enough to be under OFAC or not. And, you know, we don't require and we don't monitor our contracted parties for whether or not they are complying with OFAC.
Thank you, Sam. I'll turn to Jeff Newman.
Yeah, thanks. This is sort of a corollary. Actually, I have two questions. One is sort of a corollary to that, and that would be, would ICANN compliance find it a breach of the ICANN agreement, whether it's a registry agreement, registrar accreditation agreement? Would it be a breach if that entity did violate the OFAC regulations? In other words, in each of the ICANN agreements, it says that you must follow applicable law. If for whatever reason OFAC sanctioned a contracted party, that would in theory be a breach of the ICANN contract, the applicable ICANN contract. So has that been something that you all have thought about? That's question one, and then I'll go to the second one.
Thanks, Jeff. In general, yes. You know, any contracted party that's been found in violation of a law, so this isn't just an allegation but a finding of being in violation of law, could be something that would lead to further compliance action. Now, there would be other questions, I'm sure, from our compliance department, and you might wish to talk to them further about how they handle situations when a registry or registrar has been actually found in violation of a law, and whether or not it always leads to termination, or if there's other paths on their enforcement based on the materiality of the law that they broke or whatever. But it is something that could, under the terms of the contract, put a contracted party onto a path leading to breach and termination. But I think that's a question that's better asked to the compliance team.
Okay, thanks. And then the second question is more on the language that's on the – I'm looking at the ICANN page on registrar accreditation, and I guess this would also apply to registries for new GTLDs going forward. So the question I have is that it says that ICANN generally will not seek a license to provide goods or services to an individual entity on the SDN list. In the past, it goes on to say that you have been granted licenses, but again, there's no requirement for ICANN to actually even seek a license. And of course, we understand that even if you sought a license, it's out of your control as to whether one's granted. But I guess my question is more, shouldn't it be a requirement of ICANN to seek a license on behalf of an entity that applies to be a registry or registrar, assuming they meet all the other requirements?
Thanks, Jeff. The focus on SDN in that context is actually a really important focus. It is a general practice for ICANN when there is an application for a registry, a registrar, if it's someone who's an entity that's part of the broader countrywide sanctions, you know, the ones that attach to individuals who aren't named anywhere else, but just by virtue of being a national of that country, we would seek a license. We would, and we do. ICANN, on the other hand, is not obligated to seek licenses on behalf of those who are specifically on the SDN list. That could also raise other issues that might impact fitness to run a registry or to take on that part of being part of the DNS infrastructure like that. So there's a little bit of a difference there, but just in general, for just like we do for travelers, if we had an entity from from one of the countries that were subject to the broad sanctions that were seeking to open a registry or a registrar, we would definitely go and seek a license from on their behalf to do that.
Thank you, Sam. I see Caboose is next. Caboose, if you could please ask a concise question, it will be easier to get an answer. Thank you.
Excuse me. My question is what I raised in the questions I sent you. The OFAC, is Office for Foreign Asset Control, how DMS is constituted the asset. There were two courts in the United States during 2016, and there was no decision that the DMS, whether in form of GTLD or CCTLD, could be considered as asset. One court said that it is not decisions, it is assumption, but did not address the issue. They decide on something for the third party interest. So the issue is quite non-answered yet, whether DNS is asset. If it is not asset, I don't know how OFAC terms and conditions apply to something which is not asset. So this is something very, very important. And I asked that how, when it came to the ICANN, it was not replied that DNS does not belong to anybody. Use will be given to that, but there is no property. And GNSO, in many communications, mentioned that, for instance, they just took to the two-letter country code, that somebody says that this is belong to our country, they say that no, this does not belong to anybody. So I don't understand this double standard. So my question, is DNS asset or not? If it is not asset, how OFAC would apply to that? So the relation between DNS and this need to be replied deeply and carefully. I don't want that you jump into the conclusion now, because I have observed that you are not well prepared to do this. Then you say you don't know this, you don't know that. So I think that I need a written, logical, and legally valid written reply to these questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Caboose. So the reason that there isn't a clear answer to this is that it's not ICANN's to answer. So the Treasury Department has historically deemed that, for example, ICANN's work in relation to the root zone is something that requires a license. That's not ICANN's decision. That's the Treasury Department's decision. Does that mean that in the future, the Treasury Department could make a different decision, that the Treasury Department could say that actually, upon further review, this is just a service, and it's not actually providing it's just a function, and it's not something that you need a license for? Yes, of course that could happen, but we can't require the Treasury Department to take that position. So I understand why, you know, having a court look at the asset situation and the question around whether or not the DNS is property, or whether individual CCTLDs or other TLDs are properties that are subject of attachment, might seem incongruent, might not seem aligned with the Treasury Department's decision that a license is necessary for such conduct. But that's not ICANN's question to answer. That is something that the U.S. government and the Treasury Department has said, yes, you need a license to do that. They have the ability to say to us, you know what, you don't need a license for that anymore. We don't think that it's necessary. Have they done that? No. And so we can't answer the question of why the two parts don't go together, Caboose, and I understand why. I understand the heart of your question. It's just not a question that we have the answer to.
So someone should answer that. The jurisdiction subgroup should answer that question.
Well, with all respect, any outcome of the subgroup isn't binding on the U.S. government as to whether or not ICANN's complying or any other company is complying with their OFAC requirements. So no matter
the location of ICANN should be changed, because that's always because of the governing U.S. law that blocks everything. That is the situation. When the chair of the CCTLD will be coming and convincing the people with the revolutionary idea that let's agree that location will be there and U.S. law will apply, you have this problem. So you cannot solve the problem. We are really wasting our time, our valuable time. Thank you.
Thank you, Caboose. I don't know, Sam, if you have a response to that. If not, if you do, please go ahead. If not, we'll turn to Farzan.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that even if ICANN were picked up and moved out of the U.S. today, OFAC would likely still apply. There would still be registries and registrars that do business in the U.S. such that OFAC would still apply. And there are other countries that also have sanction regimes that likely would apply to conduct and could in some instances be even more restrictive than OFAC. So that there's not a magic tool in just picking up ICANN. So, and I think we have to keep that in mind.
Thank you, Sam. Farzana, why don't you please go ahead. We have about 5 minutes left.
Thank you. Sam, just following up on Jeff's intervention, when I looked at the registrar's accreditation agreement that was in January, it was said that the applicant acknowledges that ICANN is under no obligations to seek such licenses, meaning OFAC licenses. And now I hear that that's only about the ones that are on SDN list. Or is ICANN just not obligating itself to receive to request for an OFAC license in general based on its own assessment? Thanks.
So I know there are general practices that, particularly for those that would be, that we'd require a license to deal with because of the broad country sanction, our general practice is to seek a license. So I don't have any further ICANN position on that, but that is our general practice.
Thank you, Sam. I think Milton is next, and then we'll go to some closing points.
Yes, this question is not specifically about OFAC, but I think it's relevant, and that is about the status of DNS as an asset. So you, Sam, are probably familiar with Islamic Republic of Iran versus Weinstein's, and I just wanted your opinion. The appeals court basically refrained from redelegating the domain because they thought it would mess up the whole system of Internet governance. And I wondered if you could opine, and I know you're just opining, you're not a Supreme Court making the law, but what is your opinion of the precedent value of that appeals court decision? Does that have some kind of influence on the way things are decided in the future?
You know, I'd have to go back and look more at the appeals court decision, Milton. Typically when courts refrain from reaching certain issues, that the precedential value isn't so high. But to the extent, and this is where we get into the world of ICANN is often gets courts to break new ground, looking at how other courts have thought about issues or have refused to think about issues becomes somewhat precedential on its own, because trying to explain to a court what we do with the DNS and how ccTLDs are managed and allocated, et cetera, becomes a very difficult thing for a court to understand. And so to the extent that there is any precedent that gets developed, even if it's not squarely on point with law, tends to be helpful to inform future courts. But you know, to the extent we could have a decision that was a little bit more squarely on point with law, for a legal reason to not allow for a transfer in that case, that would of course be preferable for building the type of precedent that we'd like to see.
Thank you, Sam. I'm sorry, the queue has been closed. We've reached the top of the hour. We're just time for some closing points. Sam, I want to thank you very much for joining us here. Been very helpful. I think that this has given the group a lot to discuss. A number of points been raised here. We may, of course, ask you for a return engagement. There are also a number of questions that were raised both on the list of which were sent around with the agenda and during the call. I'm hopeful that we can see about how we can get answers to those to the extent that they weren't answered in the chat. It may be that the questions need to be made more concise or less ambiguous, but it would be helpful to get those answers. Even more, I think that you may be able to come up with some better questions, if you will, having had this discussion and enabling us to have a discussion in the group on these points. So I want to thank everyone for participating today and thank Sam for this. With that, Sam, unless you have any closing remarks, we'll proceed to end the call. Sam?
Thanks. Thanks for having me. And please let me know if you'd like me to come back again or anything, if you have other questions that you think could be addressed. In terms of closing thoughts, I think it's really important to remember, and I know that the subgroup is really trying to deal with a lot of sensitive points, but to focus on conduct that the community and ICANN can actually change, as opposed to focusing on obligations of how a government might interact with us, would probably be helpful, because it has to be something we can actually implement and not just a desire to see something framed, for example, in a general license, because we as the ICANN community actually can't make that happen. So if we can focus on actionable and implementable things, that would be really great.
Thank you, Sam. Is there anything specific that you'd like us to focus on, in your view? Obviously, we have our own latitude to form our own views for it.
Nothing specific, no.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Sam. I think with that, I will adjourn this call. We can stop the recording. Thank you all for participating, and I'm sure this will be the subject of further discussion. Have a good morning, afternoon, evening, or night. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks very much, Sam. Thanks, Greg. Bye.